When I think about Oliver Ruff, three words come to mind: consistency, present, and commitment. He has always been exactly the same, a person who cares, a person who's committed, and a person that is passionate about Evanston and the Evanston community. He grew up here, he taught school here, he was an administrator in District 65, and is still giving back to the community in monumental ways. Thank you, Mr. Ruff, for being a model of what a strong Black man should be. Listen to understand.
Hi, and welcome to Evanston Rules. I'm Larice Bell, here with Ron Whitmore. Today, we are honored to have the esteemed Oliver Ruff as our guest with the most fabulous name of Oliver. I already have a soft spot for you because you're an Oliver.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
And my grandfather was an Oliver, and my son is an Oliver.
All right.
So tell us a little bit about yourself. Were you born in Evanston? Are you a native Evanstonian?
I was reared in Evanston, but I was born in Georgia. And I was there up until about 10 years of age. I was back and forth as my mother had moved here, although I started kindergarten there when I was 6 years old. I began my official Evanstonian residency at 10 years of age at Foster Elementary School.
What was it like going to school at Foster Center?
Well, as a student in Foster School from kindergarten, it was like a family situation. Many of the teachers were your surrogate parents. Many of them had high expectations of you. They would not permit you to waste your time, not get the full value of their educational knowledge, because they wanted you to be the best that you could be. And having been around a majority Black students, you knew that there was a sense of family there, there was a sense of village, and the teachers, again, were our parents away from home. So they provided an education, expected us to do what we were supposed to do. If we didn't do it, we would get our physical reprimand. And you don't forget those values that they instill or inculcated in you were values that I still utilize nowadays.
What was the demographic of those teachers?
The predominance of teachers at that time were Black. However, there were some white teachers at Foster as well. As a matter of fact, the lady that I remember teaching me the most, and she's still around, she was beginning her first year there as a teacher, Pat Adelberg, and I still talk with her once a week now.
What was that experience like going through the Evanston school system during that time?
Well, it was an excellent experience in terms of the family connections. The neighborhood, again, I have to just reiterate, it was a village because you knew most people. Or if they didn't know you personally, they knew somebody who knew you. So that value that we had was very unique. Being at the Evanston High School, there was some of the same things that occurred, but most of the teachers that were at the high school happened to have been white. Dr. Charlie Thomas and Dr. Martin were the two Black teachers that I remembered there at the time, and both of those were my football coaches. With that being the case, you had persons who were looking out for you. There were teachers at the high school who were also, even though they were not Black, they were also ones who had high expectations. And I felt that they knew my mother, and they knew that if I didn't do what I was supposed to do, she would get the communication. And that was not always the most pleasant thing to occur.
So when did you first notice the racial disparities in Evanston?
Well, there were a number of disparities, and some of those disparities still exist. At Foster, I must say at that time, I really didn't know that much about disparities because, again, the environment that I was in, I didn't feel that until when I got to Skiles, I started seeing a bit of it. And when I got to the high school, it was much more noticeable because many of the Blacks, we affiliated with each other, whether it was in the lunchroom, on the athletic field, in the community. And then you didn't see that many African-American teachers or personnel. So there were disparities there. Instructionally, you didn't see the curriculum where there was very much taught about you as an individual, not as an individual, as a culture rather. Mm. And so there were disparities, but they were not that glaring because at that time, we didn't focus on that. We just focused on the absorption of knowledge, trying to improve ourselves so that we could be better than we were
So you say you didn't focus on it.
I didn't focus on it because my mother sent me to school to get an education. And that's all I was concerned about, is to get that education. So anything that happened that was racially discouraging or some kind of disparaging thing that would occur, that wasn't something that I was to take back home.
So though you didn't focus on it, and I understand the need to keep your eyes on the prize, what were your feelings? Because what I know is that some of these things still happen today.
Yeah.
So how would you address that for yourself as well as for the kids who are dealing with these things today?
Well, one, I happen to have had persons who were in the community who were like surrogate parents, and they kept me directed. In the high school, again, you find that many of the classes, you know, if we were in classes, you know, usually I was in a class that was considered, I suppose, one of the slower classes, and wasn't slow to that extent, but they weren't the advanced placement classes. That was where the majority of us who were Black were in those classes. Those children who were more advanced were the white children who were in the classes, and very few of us who would be in those locations. Although we were just as smart, but we didn't have the opportunities, we didn't get the considerations. Some of us have come out of school and done much better than those who were in those AP classes and in those honor classes. We were not given the same privileges and opportunities that many of the whites. There was a superficial culture where we thought that we were friends with so many of the whites. We thought we were doing academically well, but then when it came down to it, the teachers kept us segregated. The students, you know, they were friendly while we were on the football field, friendly while we were on the courts, friendly in those classes, but when we got outside, the superficiality became more apparent. And so the friendships were not the friendships that we thought they were. Mm-hmm. And so the educational information that we thought we were getting from the teachers was not always as valuable as we thought it was, it should have been, because again, the teachers treated us differently and the students treated us differently, but we persisted and pursued our goals of trying to do what we were supposed to do for the sake of our parents, because I didn't want to let my mother down. And I think that was true of so many of us, because our parents told us, you go to school to get an education, you don't question the teacher, you don't question other persons there, you do what you're told to do. And that's how I pursued my educational journey at the high school and throughout the district.
You graduated ETHS what year?
1966.
Did you experience racism in Evanston?
Oh, of course. I mean, I was in a French class, I think it was my freshman year at Evanston High School, and I'll never forget, I had written portrayed something to the extent I said in a paper that this individual portrayed a certain kind of behavior. This teacher told me that you don't use that kind of word. This is not a word that is appropriate. And I asked her, why not? I said, I'm describing what I was trying to say. This teacher told me, and I'll never forget her, she said, that's not the kind of word that you use. Mm-hmm. And it was a very distinct racist kind of betrayal on her part. But, you know, at that time, I couldn't question that because she said not to use it. I had to use another word. But those were just the subtleties that occurred. The teacher made sure that I didn't use any word that sounded like it may be a white word. And pardon me for a lack of a better description. The terminology that whites would use, we were not expected to use that same terminology because we were being something that I don't think they wanted to accept us as being. And I think that was just common for so many of the students. And that was kind of psychologically disturbing because oftentimes we could not present ourselves in such a way that we were as intelligent as we were. They wanted us to project an image that was less. Also, athletically, you could be on a team. I know I was much better than some of the other athletes on the football team, and they were in front of me. And I kill myself to be the best that I could be, and we would share a position.
Mr. Ruff, we talk about the cognitive dissonance and how that relates to the systematic racism and oppression that often Black people in Evanston or Black people around the world go through. You're sent to school, you're a student that is intelligent, you're trying to do what your mom has asked you to do, but you keep facing these roadblocks based on race. That had to have an effect on you. Can you describe how those instances impacted you, either positively or negatively?
Of course. Again, having had persons like Mr. Hill, Joe Hill, and other persons in the district who were influential in our lives, those were motivational aspects to give us the tenacity to feel that we weren't going to be denied a positive education. But those impacts that we got from persons such as this teacher I was describing and others, where they would say to you or they would perform a certain behavior to make you feel that you were less than others, you know, right. Yes, that impacted us differently. But again, because I just had the expectation from my mother that I was not to fail. And with that expectation that I was not going to fail in spite of whatever a person said or did, that allowed me to persist and to have the desire to do those things that were out of what the expectations were of some of the teachers.
Jay-Z says, the motivation for me is them telling me what I cannot be. You know, often white America tells us we've got to pull ourselves up by the bootstraps and we don't have the boots to pull ourselves up with. But again, you keep talking about the importance of community. You keep talking about the fact that you had people that looked like you to believe in you outside of the perceptions that white Evanston may have had of you. Talk a little bit about how you felt when you had straps to pull your boots up based on your connection to your family and your community.
Well, of course, I was reassuring because you have these straps as you talked about, these persons that you could rely upon to give you the support, give you the guidance, give you the direction that you needed. And when you knew that these persons were going to be there, whether it's for educational purposes, whether it's for supplying you some money to buy things you needed, whatever the needs may be, these individuals that were in the community, all about you, all around you, you knew that these supportive individuals were not going to let you down, so you felt that you couldn't let them down. And that was the encouragement to keep me aligned and focused so that I didn't become a failure.
But we know that there are subtle and not so subtle pieces of behavior and actions and information that continue to hold us back.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So when you say there was an image projected and the white teacher wanted you to speak a certain way or not speak a certain way, what does that mean?
Yes, as we know that there were a multiplicity of images that whites had of us at that time. If you were perceived to be the good guy, or if you were perceived to be the outcast, whatever image they may have, they projected you in that particular role. And sometimes, depending on what relationship you have with those individuals, they would allow you to exceed out of that position, or they would depress you by some comment or some behavior to place you further in that role. So again, as you talked about, the microaggressions were individuals who would do all they could sometimes to just say, well, it was almost like the terminology, you stay in your place. And that's what, you know, the situation was. And you had to not allow yourself to get drowned into that ditch, because if you did, you would not succeed. But yet I think we had enough people that we were friends with that we would get together after school and we would work together on our homework, work together in whatever assignments that we had to get our work done, or if it were an athletic event, try to improve our skills so that we bonded as a group. And that's what our association was. We would not allow each other to fail in spite of what projections we got from teachers or other community personnel.
Mr. Ruff, and what made you want to become an educator?
When I was younger, I wanted to be a mortician. And then as I grew older, I started working with the recreation department, started working with youngsters at Sky Hill School. And that was when I was in high school myself. And I got interested in children. And I continued to work with them even as I went through the high school. So I decided to go to college and major in elementary education. I wanted to become a teacher.
And what is Sky Hill School?
Sky Hill is it's the school that King Lab is now. Sky Hill was Sky Hill Junior High School. That was where I attended as a student. And I also became an assistant principal there. And when it became King Lab, I was also assistant principal at King Lab. So I think I'm the only living person who's been assistant principal at both of those locations as different names.
And why did Skiles close?
I think because when Foster had the fire and then they started using the students from Foster to desegregate, and then it became King Lab. And that was the reasoning for Skiles closing, or for them to discontinue the use of that name.
You know, it's interesting as we think about the 360 degrees of Evanston, right? Yes. I remember Skiles. I remember College Hill. I remember Miller. I remember Washington when the Latinx community was thriving. And they also used that population to desegregate schools.
Yes.
And moving them from Washington, where they had the PTA, where they could walk to school, all the way over to Orrington. Mm-hmm. Why is that okay in Evanston?
Well, I don't know. I know that during the 70s, when Dr. Coffin was here, there was a big push for desegregation. And we became the victims of the desegregation process. And any school that had a preponderance of African Americans because of us always being manipulated, matriculated for that process, that was the reason of acceptance. I think because we are not typically or have not been typically those type of individuals who presented a lot of protests when they move us someplace.
So, Mr. Ruff, let's take that experience full circle, if you will. You taught in District 65. You were an administrator in District 65. How did those experiences in Evanston motivate you to be the kind of administrator that you are or were, right? And how did you instill in every student that you came in contact with that same type of motivation you received from your community?
Let me say that again, and I'm repeating myself a great deal because it was just so important for me to highlight the fact that there were a number of people in my life that encouraged me, instilled certain values in me, and those are the values that helped me get to where I had, you know, I got to. Again, many of those educators, once I got out of school, went on to college, came back and became an educator. A person such as Warren Cherry was my best friend and also became my mentor. And so we were there to try to encourage one another to be the best that we can be. And I tried to emulate him, and he on occasion would try, I guess, emulate me, and we would both try to emulate Mr. Hill, who was both of our mentors. And so there were occasions when we would have to look upon one another to keep us from getting discouraged, keep us from going down a path of non-productivity. And that's what we taught our students. My motto as a youngster, I guess in high school, I developed it: high expectations, no exceptions, no excuses. There and is. That was something that I developed. I used it as I became a teacher, as I became an administrator, and I used it until retirement and even after that. And that's what I did with my daughter and with persons I came in contact in the school setting. You are not here to fail. I'm not going to let you fail. Before I let you fail, I will, and pardon me, but I'm being very honest with you, I will hurt you. And you know, I don't mean physically, but I would not go to allow you to fail, because my job was to provide an opportunity for you to get an education. And I'm your parent while you're at school. If you start acting up, acting out, my job, from my personal experience and my personal desire, was to see you become the best that you could become. I knew many of the students' parents. Mm-hmm. I had an obligation to fulfill my educational responsibilities to their students because of my relationship with them and because of my accountability to the children, but also because I just felt that there was that camaraderie. You couldn't define it. It was just such a special connection that I just could not allow any student who came through my path to fail. And as many of the students thought that I was firm, hard, mean, whatever the case may have been, but later on I found out that they came back and thanked me, because when they would get derailed, I would try to get them steered back into the right path, and most of them have been fairly successful.
Mr. Ruff, do you see color?
Of course. I would be lying if I said I didn't, and I think that anybody who says that they don't see color, I think they're misrepresenting the truth from my perspective. Now, I think that seeing color and seeing value are two different things. I think that I see the value in persons individually, but I do see the color of every individual. And so I just think that there are some people who are out there to do the best they can for everybody in spite of your color. Mm. And that, I think, is what maybe some are saying when they say, I don't see color. They're trying to do what's right and do what's just in spite of the pigmentation.
Well, did integration work?
That's a difficult question. The reason I say it's difficult, because if you ask if it worked, integration, the intent behind it was supposed to work, but the behavior and the practice, no, it hasn't worked, because in some ways we're worse off in many categories than we were before. In some ways, yes, we are better off. Is it working? You know, that's, some people would say yes, some would say no. I don't think that it has worked to the advantage of us in many categories.
So it makes me think the teacher who did not want to hear you saying words that she didn't think were right for you.
Wonderful words, intelligent words.
Yes.
You know, she needed you to be simple, mm-hmm. right?
Expected yes. you to be simple.
Demanded that you be simple. And in that, it's the pain of being excited to learn and bring something and being told that your words were too big. Your thoughts were too much. What image was projected?
Well, it was almost like that enslavement attitude, to the extent that, having come from down south and being part of a sharecropping process, you were always thought of as being less than who you are and what you are, because you could not mature and develop as you wanted to. So when you get into a classroom with a teacher who projected that same kind of attitude, it psychologically depressed you, but you didn't know at the time what it was doing to you, but it put a certain kind of weight in your mind and your spirit that you didn't want to evolve out of that cocoon of intelligence.
That made you hate yourself, made you think that you were less than, made you think that you couldn't be brilliant. They yes. did a job on us mentally.
Yes, and that's what I'm talking about, that cocoon, because we got in there and some of us never got out. And those of us that got out, we never matured to the stages that we wanted to, because we were already set back by what they did psychologically and mentally for us.
It's just, I'm thinking that in our parents' love for us, because they knew
that if we spoke up, what that would do. It's yes. picking between two evils.
Yes.
And that to me is the heartache and the heartbreak and the criminality of it, actually. There was harm. That was criminal. That when you go to school to learn, they actually try to keep you from learning. They try to keep you off the track of going to college. Well, you don't have money. Well, there are scholarships. There are all sorts of ways if people are determined to help make that happen. And I think our trust and our desire, and even if it's not trust, but our desire to go along, to get along.
Say that again.
Our desire to go along, to get along has not helped us. In fact, it's harmed us, and we have to do it differently. And our parents, I hope, who are out there who have their children in these programs, feel confident enough with what is going on now, with a school being built, with Horton in, with the support in. You know, it's kind of crazy that this has gone on for how long? This idea of getting a new school, this idea of getting a school in the Fifth Ward.
In all fairness to our parents or our ancestors, let me just respond to the fact that, you know, what was the statement? We went along to get along. Was that your statement? Our parents had taught us, and this again is, you know, your grandparents, great grandparents, taught us to do that because we had to navigate a system that was set up to suppress so many areas of our creativity, our maturity, and all these other things. The system was taught up, as you, one of you said, both of you said, to criminally defeat us in every areas that we were trying to progress in. And if we were to be defiant towards not only a white person, but, you know, persons that were in authority, we could be beaten, hurt, maimed, or whatever the
killed.
Case may have been, killed. And in many cases, cited that we were killed. So our parents were teaching us this for survival.
Exactly.
So I don't fault them for that. I developed some of the same behaviors because that was what I wanted for my daughter. So it's been taught to us, and the system still exists, that we are still having to do certain things to get along because of the law. We know that dealing with the law, sometimes if we get out of our car and ask them why are they stopping us for some reason, more than likely we're going to be incarcerated or killed or injured some kind of way. White can do it. That does not typically happen where he or she gets that same kind of behavior. So now that's one thing. The other thing is that you're definitely correct. Nowadays, we do not need to continuously acquiesce to all of the things that we are being asked to do, because if we do that, we're going to remain in that same ditch that we've been in for years. And we've got to elevate ourselves out of that in whatever method that's available. So we're not doing things just to appease nowadays. We have people who are beginning to, and I say beginning, to do things on their own.
In 1957, schools got desegregated. Charles Ogletree, in his book, All Deliberate Speed, gives a very clear depiction of the system of integration and the lack thereof for Black people in the integration. There was no clear plan, right?
Right.
My frat brother, Kyle Sutton, said in a meeting Saturday that the Fifth Ward was now 11% Black.
Yeah.
White folk are moving into the Fifth Ward, 40 going north, buying houses.
Yeah.
And now they're going to get a state-of-the-art school. So what is that school going to look like in 5 to 10 years? It's going to be all white. I 100% support the Fifth Ward, and I loved Dr. Horton's strength and commitment in the middle of this chaos.
Mm-hmm.
Dealing with what's right for Black kids. But on the backs of Black kids, schools got integrated in Evanston.
Right.
On the backs of Black kids, there was a gap created in education in Evanston. And now on the backs of Black kids, 56 years later, a school's going to come in the Black community that's no longer going to be Black. So why is it that we as Black people focus on what we get rather than how to use what we get to enhance our struggle? We need 56 more years of Foster Center, the new school, being Black. How do we do that?
Those are concerns that we have talked about. We're continuously talking about. We're going to have some engaging conversations with the superintendent, board personnel, and with district staff to talk about the structuring of that school, from how we're going to set it up, the number of Black teachers, as you probably heard me say, and I've been talking about this for years, we have less than 10 Black male teachers in the entire district. We had 4 or 5 a few years ago. So we've increased some with Dr. Horton, but we still don't have that many. And part of it is they use the explanation.
We can't find them. We can't find them.
That's exactly right. And some of that may be correct to the extent that you can't find them because you don't go out looking for them.
Yep.
And I think that we've got to have a more aggressive and a more relevant approach in seeking Black men. And also maybe it may require that we use some incentives to get them here. If we get them here and have something, whether it's housing, you know, entice them to come because they could be making as much money someplace else. And this is what has happened. They go and make as much money or more in another area. And so living here, having to be subjected to certain conditions that they would not be subjected to in another community, the men decide to go there. They may have greater opportunities to progress in that system. It may not be the same thing here. I think Dr. Horton is setting up some profiles for that to be ultimately a future goal, a future attainment for others, rather. But I think that it's, all of this is in progress. It's been such a difficult obstacle to overcome because the structure has not been necessarily in place.
Knowing that you are in that room?
Yes.
I am so much more comfortable that that conversation is going to happen continually. And our hope is that that school continues to be predominantly Black. We've always had the 70-30, 60-40 split in District 65.
Right.
And no one yelled racism when that was happening. We've always had Black and brown kids being bused. Right. So we hope that at least for the next 56 years, Foster Center goes back to what it originally was, serving the community, serving people of color.
Well, and the community's changing.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say. I don't think that if we say community, it will be serving our Blacks because of the percentage. If some structure is set up saying that there will be priority given to Blacks in the Everson area at a certain percentage, then that may be something worth considering. But as you both have stated, due to the fact that we've had the gentrification, we've had the just a total flight of Blacks for different reasons, you know, we don't have our numbers.
Yeah.
And the numbers we do have, many of them are there who don't have students of that attendance level.
So for the record, I meant Black community. Thank you both for correcting me. Oh, I want to say it. I meant Black community.
Well, to have the Black community, we have to have more Blacks moving in. With 11%, certainly will not give us that percentage that we need for our schooling.
So how do we entice? How do we bring back?
One big way is to start off with the housing. And you know, we know right now, it's almost, I used to live on in the 1900 blocks of Jackson and when I was a youngster. And within that, at this point, it's almost, I can't say unbearable, but it's difficult for many Black families to move over even in that location because of the cost of homes now. And so the way you entice it is having some subsidized housing or some ability for those persons who cannot afford it, but who are willing to remain in Evanston, who are willing to take care of property and do these things that you look for in homeowners. And that's not just Blacks, anybody. You're looking for somebody who's going to take care of homes and who's going to hopefully have some stability there in terms of longevity, then you want to get those people there and do whatever you can to help them pay for their mortgages or rent or whatever they what's necessary for them to be in that community.
So I appreciate this conversation because it's important and we have to look forward. But I can never just look forward without looking back.
Yes.
And thinking about all those who didn't get opportunities, who were stuck, who died without ever seeing what they should have seen, who never had a 401k, who never had a retirement plan because of the work they were doing.
Who never had a teacher that cared about them.
You know, I think about the names people were called, the horrible things that happened, the people who got into a system and might have been in jail because of something small, whereas if the white guy did it, he would have received a pat on the back and said, go on, do your thing.
Right.
I think about the women who were not offered opportunities, but who were leaned on and raised people's children. Yeah. And so it's bittersweet for me. It's bittersweet, and I know it's bittersweet for everyone. Yeah. So I want to feel good and congratulatory, but I go to all those to whom a statue should be built. And beyond that, that we should be honoring them, all those who had to leave town, who are living elsewhere because they've been pushed out, which is gentrification. And it's still happening. So I want to be positive. I want to feel good about this. And yet, you know, every time they give us a little something,
they take.
I'm wondering what's going to happen because the process is something else. The results are something else.
Right. Well, let me say to you that I think you both are absolutely correct that, you know, we need to have something that's going to honor our Black community, our population. There are some fringes of that, I guess, that we have to deal with genuinely as a people. Sometimes we get in a room and we're at so many odds with one another until we can get to the point of unifying in concept and approach as to what we feel, even if we differ. Let's get to a point where we can work together for the betterment, because if I see that you're split, divide and conquer will occur. And then I think that that is a nemesis that we've got to overcome with us. That's the concern. However, I do feel that with that, it's going to require that with the community that we're in, having a statue would certainly be a nice tribute, but I even go beyond that. I think a statue is more symbolic. My statue would be providing a school that's going to provide the relevant education, and the coherent education is going to do the things that are necessary to upgrade our Black population, student population, so that the testing gap, if they're still using that as a measure, whatever the gap may be, so that the educational level can increase with our students. So by the time they get to high school and college, they are succeeding just as or better than the white students.
What advice would you provide District 65 today regarding the gap?
Well, I would like to feel that we have to understand that no matter what we are doing, if we can't help Black children become more successful and we can't mitigate that achievement gap in reading, math, and all the gaps with our Black students, then District 65, to me, minimizes its view of successes. And I don't care how many people have done reasonably well, there's still that real pivotal point that I feel that's not a success. And I think that the teachers have got to be held more accountable. I think that unfortunately, we as adults have to, as parents, have to be held accountable in aspects of things. But yet again, I, as an educator, when I was an educator, I didn't blame parents for not being able to teach their kids, because I felt it was my job as the educator to do that. And that's what I was getting paid to do. Yes, obviously, sir. It makes it a little easier when you've been given a foundation by your parents that's going to help you, you know, be successful. But you know, that's not a criteria for success, because, and I'm digressing a little bit, my mother had an eighth grade education, but my mother had an expectation for me every night, even though she couldn't help me with my work, I was to be at that table, whether I was doing the assignment correctly or incorrectly, I better be there pretending I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. And the work that I'm supposed to turn in, I don't want to hear, she would say, I don't want to hear the teacher saying that you didn't turn it in. So again, parents need to hold their kids accountable. Parents need to hold us as educators accountable. And I think that the curriculum, persons who are in the district, Everson needs to get more persons of color, more Black teachers. Good Black teachers who can come in and help to encourage some of our Black students. Because sometimes when you don't have persons who are of light appearance, sometimes it makes it a little bit more uncomfortable for you as an individual to be successful in that school. There are only 7 Black male teachers in Everson. Mm. 7.
Wow.
And that's astounding.
Okay.
Mm. And that's something, because many of our Black boys need a male figure.
We need to see ourselves to be ourselves.
Thank you. Exactly. And that encouragement is sometimes so crucial to the success of the students.
You mentioned that we were missing a pivotal point in education. And I'm wondering what that pivotal point is.
Well, the pivotal point, as I see it, is one, being providing an eye of equity so that students who are in District 65 and in the high school as well be given the opportunity where they can get a complete education and not a one-sided education, an opportunity for their education. Whether it's curricularly, whether it's through association with persons of similarity, whether it is through living circumstances in Everson. As we know now, many Blacks are moving out of Everson because we can't afford to live in Everson because of the housing, because of taxes and other aspects. It's reducing, as somebody pointed out, one of you pointed out earlier, that our population, Black population, has decreased. And we were used to be 23%, I think it's 16 now. I think, can you say that, Ms. Bell?
Yes.
And so that is a very discouraging point. So it's pivotal for us to start elevating and not de-accelerating. And I think if we don't start elevating some of those opportunities and some of those advantages that are going to help the Blacks get better, because I don't think Everson's going to be better until our Black population is doing better. And that's so important to me, because, you know, we can do all we can to talk about what needs to be done, but until we start actualizing it, the verbiage means nothing. The community is not going to grow until we collectively grow together. Again, Joe Hill, who mentored all of the Blacks, and had it not been for somebody like him, I don't know whether I would have succeeded, because I didn't have a father in my home at the time to help motivate me and navigate me through the system.
So how would you like to be remembered?
I'd like to be remembered again as being somebody who did the best he could to do right by others so that they can have the opportunity and experience of some of the opportunities that I had to hopefully help somebody else. And if I can be remembered by the fact that I tried to pay forward those privileges and those opportunities that Joe Hill or Warren Cherry, some of the others made available for me. If I can help somebody else grab my coattail to move upward, that's what I would like to do. I'd like to be able to say that I helped somebody become better than he or she thought they could become. Keep
all the pressure. I want to thank everybody for joining us today and coming along on this journey, and that you'll follow along with us as we continue to air a new podcast. You can find us at evansonrules.com. We're also on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and we look forward to hearing from you.